the House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, January the 31st, 2007. We have a number of bills, six bills on the agenda for hearing today, and notice for possible work session as well. We're going to generally be doing those in order, except that we're going to take up the first and last bills, 2305 and 2381st, in hopes that we can dispose of these fairly promptly, because there's been a law change that will affect that. So I am going to open public hearings on both 2305 and 2380 together. Council, could you brief us on this?
Thank you, Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. I'm looking first at House Bill 2305. It and 2380 both apply to the what's called the Interfering with the Peace Officer Statute, ORS 162.247. With regard to 2305, 2305 arose in response to a Court of Appeals decision in 2005, State versus Illig Wren. And what this court did in Illig Wren was to find one prong of ORS 162.247 unconstitutional, this so-called refusal to obey a lawful order by the police. Court of Appeals found it unconstitutional. House Bill 2305 arose in response to try to remedy that situation. In the meantime, Oregon Supreme Court in 2006 overturned the Court of Appeals. 341 OR 228 is the site, and found that the lawful order prong of this statute was constitutional. So the fix that House Bill 2305 was trying to address is no longer an issue. On 2380, it also applies to the crime of interfering with a peace officer, 162.247. House Bill 2380 added a third prong with regard to persons who knowingly flee, peace officer or parole and probation officer who has a right to stop the person. It also does not appear that, given prong two is constitutional, the lawful order prong, it doesn't appear that there's a need for 2380 either.
We have several witnesses signed up on each of these bills, but I think we've heard that they are, for the most part, mooted by a prior court case, and that the reason that these bills were brought forward does not continue to apply. And so I would ask, it would be the chair's intent not to work these bills, unless there's some interest in them on part of the committee members. I think we could probably urge our signed-up witnesses not to come and take up committee time doing that. Any interest in pursuing this? Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific interest in pursuing, and I'm thankful for the explanation that as the statute is currently now upheld by the Court of Appeal, that we don't need to deal with these. I just found the language in 2380 a little interesting in regard to knowingly flee the peace officer. Are we talking about has knowledge of fleeing, or fleeing knowing that there is a peace officer or parole and probation officer? So since we don't have to have that discussion, I guess I won't pursue it, but I found an interesting construction of the language.
It's reassuring to me to know that our committee members are reading the bill language carefully. So with that kind of sense from the committee, I would ask the three witnesses we have signed up, Gina Skinner, Andrea Meyer, and Amy Alkanich, whether they have any desire to come and present on these bills. I see the heads shaking no, and so with that, we will not receive any testimony on these bills. I will close the public hearings on House Bill 2305 and 2380. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2336. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2336 prohibits setting aside a conviction or a record of arrest in domestic violence cases, including when the dismissal is the result of diversion. ORS 137.225 establishes a mechanism for defendants who actually are convicted of crimes or for persons who are arrested and then not subsequently charged to set aside their conviction or their record of arrest. When something is set aside, it's as if it never happened, and the person is lawfully allowed to state, "I was never arrested or convicted." that only applies to certain classes of crimes. Several Class C felonies, many misdemeanors and violations are eligible. What House Bill 2336 would do would be to amend ORS 137.225 by adding two specific exceptions. And by exceptions, that means that persons with these convictions or dismissals are not eligible to get convictions set aside. One, domestic violence convictions. Two, domestic violence diversionary dismissals. That would be when somebody goes into a diversion program as a result of being charged with a domestic violence offense. It does not appear to apply to somebody charged with deep domestic violence who doesn't enter diversion or is never convicted.
Okay, we have one witness signed up in favor of the bill and several against. Let's hear first from the proponent, Gina Skinner from the ODAA.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. I've been a deputy district attorney now for almost 10 years, and I have been prosecuting domestic violence crimes primarily as my focus during that entire period of time. I have provided some written notes to be able to assist the committee in understanding the purposes that the District Attorney Association has in this bill. One, just for your information, one of the exceptions to the current expungement law is that DUII in all traffic offenses are also not expungible. This, and so our position is that this would be similar. There are certain crimes that are crimes that victims need to know about, the public needs to know about, and police officers need to know about when they're dealing with offenders, and one of which is DUII. And under DUII, currently, if you get a conviction for DUII or if you successfully complete a diversion under DUII, it is not expungible. The reason for that is so that their record can adequately and correctly be looked at when sentencing them for further convictions. And in addition to that, if somebody is to be eligible for diversion on a DUII, then they could not have had a previous diversion for a DUII. This is similar to this situation we're dealing with domestic violence crimes. And just for your information, on the bottom of my written materials, I've defined 135-230, and that is the statute that defines domestic violence under Oregon law. So only the statutes that met that definition would be the crimes that we're actually dealing with here in this particular situation. So what we are looking at is if somebody, for example, gets a conviction of an assault for, and it's a domestic violence crime, they have a subsequent assault for conviction, it is a felony under Oregon law. It's why it's important to have that first conviction remain on the record so that the second one, which is, it is in fact a second conviction against the same victim, gets treated appropriately and they are sentenced appropriately for the harm that they have put on that victim. Is the same thing with the DUII. You get three DUIIs, the fourth one is a felony. That's why it's important to know exactly how many they have had, and it is not appropriate for them to continue to be able to drop off that last one by having it dismissed. The same thing for being eligible for a diversion program. What we're asking for is that the arrest itself, if they successfully complete the diversion program, would not be dismissed. There wouldn't be a conviction on the record. They wouldn't have a conviction. So that would not affect rights they would have as being a person without convictions. It's just that the arrest would show so that if they assault another domestic partner, that most diversion programs would then not allow them to do another diversion program and have another domestic assault not be a conviction on the record because they've already had one opportunity to do that. And that's the same way that the Oregon law is currently with DUI diversions. So summarizing, the important thing is that we want victims to be able to have their offenders have some truth in sentencing as far as the judges knowing how many prior domestic violence convictions does this offender have when he's being sentenced. If he's eligible for a felony, he or she should be charged with the felony because of the prior conviction having remained on their record and not be dismissed. And if they're eligible for diversion, that should be based on the fact that they actually have never had a prior conviction or actually have never completed a diversion program, and that this, in fact, is the first time, and then they would be most likely eligible for a diversion program. Are there any questions from the committee members?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I have a big picture question. I understand the rationale that you're talking about in having to know the prior history in these particular cases, but there has to be some public policy behind why we allow expunging any criminal records. And so I'm wondering if in fact we say that we have to know the prior history for particular cases, what do we look for in deciding which cases those are? Because there is a public policy that we allow expunging some records. So I'm just trying to figure out where that line is drawn.
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, having not been involved in the original drafting of the expungement statute, all I can answer that question is by saying when looking at the statute, which luckily you have a copy of it as far as the bill, and so you can look at the other provisions, it actually is quite long and a little bit complicated reading through it for the first time. But some themes that you can see are that certain crimes are allowed to be expunged currently after you've had you've gone 3 years with having just that conviction. You go 3 years, you can apply to expunge certain crimes. If you have multiple crimes, you have to wait 10 years. But if you look at the kinds of crimes, they look at some C felonies and most A misdemeanors. But most of the crimes that affect things that the public potentially could be at risk from this person, that those are the kinds of crimes that are usually not expungible. For example, all sex crimes are not expungible. Crimes that are dealing with a lot of the crimes against children, with children as the victims of criminal mistreatment and endangering the welfare of a minor under certain circumstances, those kind of crimes are not expungible under any circumstances. And as I mentioned before, all traffic offenses are not expungible, so you can't get anything off of your traffic record. And again, the way the District Attorney Association looks at that is that those are the kinds of crimes that it is important for victims, generally in the public, to know about somebody before they are, because you have the right as any citizen to go to the Oregon State Police and purchase a copy of anybody's criminal record anywhere. And so some people think it's really important to know if they're getting to know somebody, whether it's a child care provider or somebody that they're, you know, have as a friend or in a relationship, whether that person has any sex offenses on their record, if that person has any domestic violence on their record. Those are things that are important to know for a lot of situations, and the public has the right to know that. And the same thing for the traffic offenses. That affects their ability to maintain a license, their ability to operate their motor vehicle safely in the community, and that affects the public at large.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. In regard to the requested amendment B, sub being here, a person convicted of a crime involving domestic violence. Now, supposing that a person is in fact convicted of a crime of domestic violence as stated, but on appeal or through the process and on appeal, the person is found to be not guilty, and by virtue of the domestic situation, it was basically frivolous and malicious by virtue of one party against the other party in the domestic situation. How then do you protect the future rights of the person that has been significantly wronged in that scenario?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, if a charge gets overturned on appeal, then that would no longer be a conviction, and it would also not be a successful diversion completion. So that would not fall under any, that would be as if they were found not guilty at trial. If a defendant is convicted and then it gets appealed, that conviction gets appealed, and the appeal comes back to us, then we have to decide if we're going to retry that person, or if enough evidence has been suppressed by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court that we are no longer able to go forward on that case, and then that case is dismissed. If that were to occur, that would not affect either of these provisions because it would not that would be able to be expungible.
You may.
Thank you. Then what are the statutes that would clearly provide for that?
Well, it just wouldn't fit under this because the case itself would have been dismissed by our office, or the person would be found not guilty. And so if other those circumstances, then it would not be a conviction and it would not be a successful dismissal after successful diversion. Because as part of the diversion program, you have to plead guilty. And so that's the crux of that part of it, is that there's a guilty plea and then a probationary period of anywhere from 12 to 24 months, and then a successful completion of all the terms of that probation. So I guess it's hard to say, because there's not a statute that says you can't do that, but there's no statute that applies. These are all the statute that talks about what is able to be expunged just goes through and talks about what can be expunged. But if you have nothing to start out with, then there's nothing to expunge, because if something is dismissed or is found not guilty, then it's not
overturned on appeal.
Well, that would be basically the same thing.
May? Thank you. And perhaps, Mr. Chair, this would be more of a question for you, and it is not part of the requested amendment, but further down in paragraph 9, I'm curious about the perhaps law 101 or legal theory that determines for the purposes of any civil action in which truth is an element of a claim for relief. I find that an interesting phraseology, since truth should be an element of everything in our judicial system. So why are we particularly providing in which truth is an element of a claim for relief?
Representative, I am not any expert on this area of the law, and so I won't. I think that's maybe a bit of a digression from our main issue here. But I would urge you to get together with Counsel Stanford, because I think you could probably shed some light on that.
Defamation type actions. The law specifically provides that truth would be an affirmative defense. What sub 9 appears, just looking at it for the first time, to be talking about is you have this situation where the law allows you to get rid of, pretend that something that did happen never happened through expungement. And this, it relates to a strange hypothetical that maybe you and I could talk about.
I would like later to have that follow-up conversation.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, who makes the decision that that person's going to be given an opportunity to have a diversion?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Krieger, that is an interesting question. Currently, under Oregon law provides for the ability to district attorney's offices to create diversion programs. There is not currently a statutory scheme that mandates offices to do it. And my understanding is that most counties in Oregon, of the ones that do provide that option, they have different programs, and those are run by the counties individually. Some counties don't even have a diversion program available at all. For example, in Washington County, where I'm from, we have a program that is basically drafted up by the district attorney's office, but there's one judge that basically runs the program, and then we have one probation officer who's the probation officer for all those offenders, and so we have a very delineated program with very clear criteria about who are eligible for that program.
You may.
What this does has me concerned, because it would mean that the district attorney has provided diversion, and I guess you wouldn't give it to someone who you consider was going to be dangerous in the future, would you?
Again, Chairman Pearson, Representative Krieger, each county has their own criteria about who they would allow into a diversion program. As provided as part of all the diversion programs that I have seen counties have, there would be a requirement that if they meet the criteria that county had set out, they would have to plead guilty to the crime that they are being charged with. They would have to be on probation for a period of time and complete domestic violence counseling and another number of other conditions that are specific to their case. And then at the completion of all of those things successfully, then the criminal conviction, the guilty plea, that would be dismissed. And so all we're asking for is the fact that they were ever arrested in the first place, would be on the record so that if they moved to a different county or they moved to someplace else, that there would be a record of this so that they wouldn't be eligible for the same opportunity to have a charge against them dismissed a second or subsequent time after that. However, if during that period of probation that they're on the diversion, if they don't successfully complete, they stop going to their counseling, they do something else that they're not supposed to do as a condition of that diversion, they've already pled guilty, and so they just come back to court, and then they're sentenced, and it's a conviction on their record at that point.
I'm not certain if that's what it says, but if they've got this diversion and they complete the diversion, they still wouldn't be able to get their record expunged, right?
But, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the distinction here is that what would not be what this bill proposes is what would not be expungible was the arrest. They would never have been convicted, and so there would be no conviction to expunge.
Follow up there, because you're putting someone in a position that they get expungement because if they completed the diversion, but their arrest isn't going to be, so they're going to actually have something hanging over their head when you look at the federal rules, where if you've had this type of violation or underneath the federal rules, then you can't have a firearm. So you're taking that person's future right away from them, even though it may have been that. And mama gets mad at you, and she calls in, and you get one of them's going to go to jail whenever the police officer comes. I think that this is something that I cannot go along with and will not go along with. This very bill I killed last session. I'll just leave it at that.
If I could just respond very briefly to one point, Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. I understand your concern, and the only thing that I'm going to respond to is that the federal law would apply to convictions of domestic violence, assault for domestic violence, not just to the arrest. There are a lot of people that are arrested, but the district attorney's office never charges the offense where people are arrested and charges are dismissed along the way because we don't feel that we have the evidence to go forward to trial. And those arrests would not comport with this, and the federal law would apply to convictions only.
Any further questions for Ms. Skinner? Thank you, Ms. Skinner. Then the next name on our sign-up list is Herb Router from Washington County. Mr. Router, and please identify yourself for the record here before you remark.
My name is Herb Router. I'm from Washington County, and I'm here in opposition to 2356. I have a painful story to tell, in that I myself was arrested for crime of domestic violence harassment, actually. I had been virtually listening to a lecture from my wife about some of my shortcomings on one evening, and got into a discussion, and I came over next to her recliner, talked to her, and she reclined the chair quickly. I was standing very close to the already raised pedestal of the recliner, and it hit me. I lurched forward slightly, touched the chair with one hand and her with the other. The chair fell over, and she has diabetes and had a low blood sugar event at that point. And she became afraid. I grabbed her. She was still laying on her side, and I was on the ground. I got up on one knee, grabbed her, tried to hold her back in the chair, and then set the chair back upright. At that time, she reached for something on the table next to me, and I didn't know what it was, and it was coming towards my head, and I grabbed it. I stood up and I go, what are you doing? And it was a telephone, although there are several devices of that size, that shape on, you know, TV controllers and whatever. And I put it back down. And then she unreclined her chair and got up and ran in the other room and got on the phone and called 911 and reported that I had attacked her. So one thing led to another, and I was charged with misdemeanor assault, harassment and interfering with a police investigation. I was mainly charged, I guess, because when the police first came, I went out to my shed, which is like an office, really. And I was sitting there petting my cat waiting for him to show up. And when they came in, they asked me, you know, they told me that my wife said I had attacked her and so on, and they asked me what happened. And I started to explain. I says, well, and then my hand went up. And he says, you're lying. And I says, well, I'm not lying, but I'm not going to say anything else. He says, okay. Then they started to put cuffs on me. And then I go, well, what are we doing? Am I under arrest? He goes, no. I go, well, if you're putting cuffs on me, I'm under arrest. I want to know what the charges are. And he says, there are no charges. We're doing this for your safety and our safety. I says, well, I got two armed men in front of me in an 8x10 room. I got nothing. And you're saying that your safety is... I didn't understand that either. But anyway, they handcuffed me, took me out to one squad car. I sat there for about 20, 25 minutes while they took pictures in the house and did all that stuff. After I'd been searched and so on, and they removed everything from my pockets, they put me in that car. Then they came out and they said, okay, now you're under arrest, and these were the charges as I described them earlier, the assault charge, the harassment charge, and the interfering charge. So then they took me from that squad car down the street to another squad car, frog marched me with my hands behind my back chained, threw me up against that car, pushed me down, rubbed up against me, and frisked me again, and then put me in the other car. Then he took me down, and I was under arrest and processed and so on. At the first hearing, the prosecutor said I was an evil and dangerous man, and that I was, not allowed to go see my wife or talk to anybody, and I should be, permitted to a trial. So my wife was there finally and said she didn't want me arrested, that she didn't want me prosecuted, and that she wanted me to come home because she has diabetes, kidney disease, and several other things wrong with her, and didn't feel safe without me around to help her. But the judge wouldn't allow it. She said something like, they had to have it in writing. So, okay, so they had another hearing, another pretrial hearing. A couple weeks later, my wife came again, took a day off from work, brought it in writing, gave it to the judge, same judge. Again, they wouldn't allow me to go home. They still wanted to prosecute me. Finally, we get to court. They dropped the assault charge. They dropped the interfering charge, but they... Finally, I was convicted of harassment, even though she and I were the only two there. She said I didn't do it after she had recovered herself. I said I didn't do it, but they found me guilty anyway. And so I lost my rights. I became a criminal for the first time in my life. I've never been arrested previously, nor since. Now, I find that first, I had three lawyers, an assistant U.S. district attorney, and a probation department tell me that the charge for harassment would not interfere with my firearm rights for life. Then, about a year and a half later, I go into a gun store and I try and buy a gun, and I find I'm denied because I have this charge and the arrest record on my record. So, I now find that you guys want to pass a bill that would prevent me for the rest of my life from ever getting my firearm rights back. I was a gunsmith when I was younger. I went two years of school and spent thousands of dollars. I participated in all kinds of shooting sports, including Ipsy, up until the date of my arrest. I want my rights back. And I know there's guys like me who have been arrested and charged, who have never done anything wrong. All I did was set my wife back in a chair after she turned it over.
Yeah, Mr. Router, we're receiving your input on the bill, and I think we've heard your personal story. Just as a response to one of your comments, you said, you guys want to take my rights away. We're your elected representatives. A proposal's been brought forward to us. We're trying to get all the input we can about whether this is a good thing to do or not.
If I personalize it too much, I'm sorry. But from my end, it is personal. I don't know how else I'm appealing to you for a sense of justice, because at the time of my arrest, these things were all allowed. Harassment was not even considered to be a crime of sufficient weight, even by the federal government, but yet by some administrative or court decision somewhere along the line, it was. And so there I served like a double jeopardy. And now I find that people that were in my position might suffer a triple jeopardy by still having this crime on their records when previously these things had been expungible. And to me, it seems that the punishment, a lifetime of being a criminal for a minor misdemeanor, which some people don't even commit, doesn't seem to fit the crime. And that is my concern.
Okay. Are there any questions, Mr. Ryder? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ryder, for coming and sharing your story. And I'm sorry if I missed this piece. Were you actually convicted?
Oh, yes.
Did you have a trial?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I even appealed. I spent my entire retirement fund through two appeals to try to get to a federal court, but they cut me off. And then they said, well, you could get an expungement anyway, and by the time you get to a federal court through other types of constitutional appeals and so on, the expungement will already have taken place and you would have spent a lot of money for nothing. And so I said, so I gave it up.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Rowdery. Appreciate your coming in today. From our witness list, we have Kevin Sterrett. We also have Rod Harder. Are you similar enough perspectives that it might make sense for you to come forward together? Good.
For the record, members of the committee, Chair McPherson, my name is Kevin Sterrett. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Firearms Federation. I'm not going to read the prepared testimony. I think you understand what our concerns are. The whole domestic violence issue, while we in no way mean to underestimate its impact on people, the laws are drafted, domestic violence casts a very, very broad net. And our organization hears from people regularly who pleaded guilty to minor domestic issues just because it eliminated a very costly and protracted legal proceedings for them, many of them not knowing that federal law prohibits them for a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence from ever owning a single round of ammunition for the rest of their lives. And to tell you just how broad this is, if I come home one day roaring drunk and start breaking up my furniture, and my wife calls the police, and I inform the police on their arrival that it's my furniture, and my wife threatens to slap me, she can lose her firearms rights for the rest of her life. Most people have no idea that this is the case, and people call me all the time amazed to find out that a crime they committed 30 years ago that involved domestic violence, or what is called domestic violence now, prohibits them from owning a hunting rifle that they've had all their lives. They're not aware of it. Most people are not aware that this federal law was retroactive. They're not aware of the fact that it applies to law enforcement and military as well. And so, obviously, while not downplaying the gravity of domestic violence issues, we think that to single this out, and this has been brought up, that to single this particular offense out and say this cannot be expunged doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us. I mean, there still needs to be a certain, my understanding is correct, there still needs to be a certain period of time between the time of the offense and the time where the expungement could take place anyway. I think there's an opportunity to find out if somebody's genuinely dangerous. But I think we all know that it's very, very easy to have a very minor incident involving domestic partners or husbands and wives or people who live together to escalate just because of the way we approach these things now, where at one time police had a little bit more discretion about how they were going to respond to a situation like this. And now that that discretion is gone, we think that the severity of this punishment way outweighs the possible crime in the case, and we'll really urge you to consider that, how broad a net you would be throwing with this bill.
Okay, let me hear from Mr. Harder, and then we'll take questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. My concerns echo those of Mr. Sterrett, and informationally, I'd just like to point out a couple of things. Not playing down domestic violence at all. Very, very minor charges are pled guilty to, misdemeanor charges, because of the diversion program and because the individuals don't have the money for expensive court cases. So they go into that with the idea that they are going to go in this program, they're going to get their lives turned around. This is certainly a disincentive to lose your firearm rights, to plead guilty to anything. You lose your firearm rights for the rest of your life, even for a minor conviction. I would like to also point out that 135.886 very clearly sets out the criteria for diversion. And one of those criteria is that the district attorney has to agree to it. The judge sets up the program. And the most important thing about this program, and by the way, I've learned more about diversion than I ever wanted to know, is that, and I'll read it to you just very briefly, and this is in section 135.886.2a. One of the reasons to deny diversion, or one of the things that can happen, is the nature of the offense. However, the offense must not have involved injury to another person. So in this diversion program, we're not talking about somebody to beat their wife up. We're not talking about somebody that hit her with a chair or whatever. We're talking about people who did no physical injury or did not incur physical injury on someone else. Has to be an element of the diversion program. I would ask that you consider that and not take away the rights of these people to have their records expunged after they've tried to turn their life around and the court has taken part in helping them turn their life around. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for either of these witnesses? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I want to just understand, do you object to both I understand your objection to the diversion part. Do you also object to the conviction clause in the bill?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, yes, we do.
So both sections.
For both.
Seeing no further questions, we'll excuse this panel. And we have two other witnesses signed up, Andrew Meyer and Ann Christian. And if the two of you could come forward together, that would save us a little administrative time here. I'll let you choose who goes first.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I need to tell you that, as prior witnesses have said, we certainly as an organization do not support domestic violence. What we support is the opportunity for individuals to have a second chance, even if they're guilty of a domestic violence offense and go through treatment, that they have a second chance not to have a criminal conviction, not only for the gun concern, but also for other rights, such as applying for a job, where on the application you're asked, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Another thing we're in favor of is treatment. We're in favor of diversion programs, and we have a bill that we are having drafted that would allow diversion to be determined by the judge as opposed to the district attorneys as far as opportunities to individual. So not to belabor our testimony, I would simply say that we oppose both proposed new subsections, subsection B, and subsection C in particular. But with respect to B, where a person actually has been convicted, you've heard testimony, and Representative Flores has brought up the situation where a person is convicted and then they appeal. Just needs to be made clear that when an individual appeals a conviction, the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court does not engage in a retrial and actually find the person not guilty. The only thing that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court can look at is not the facts, but whether there was an error in the law. And so an individual who's been wrongly convicted, unless there's a legal issue, will not be exonerated, if you will, by an appellate court. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and to say that we do oppose this bill. I'd contacted Kevin Neely to discuss the possibility of some amendment that OCDLA was interested in, but and those discussions are continuing, but it would not necessarily do away with our concern about subsection C in particular. Thank you.
Let's hear from Ms. Meyer, and then we'll take questions.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. My testimony will be very brief today. We entirely agree with the reasons brought forth by Ms. Christian on behalf of OCDLA today. It's a policy issue that we're concerned about. I think Representative Bonamici captured the majority of our concerns and as expressed by the previous witness. So we would urge you not to pass this bill.
Any questions for this panel? No further questions, and I have no one else signed up on House Bill 2336. This bill will not be taken to work session today, so I'll close the public hearing. Next up is House Bill 2339. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2339. Nelson Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2339 allows the state or the defense in criminal actions to obtain financial records by subpoena. It establishes a procedure for the service of and the response to the subpoena, and it specifically states that grand jury subpoenas do not require personal service upon a customer whose financial records are sought.
We have Walt Beglaw, the Marion County District Attorney, here on behalf of ODA. Mr. Beglaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Office. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, here in certain support of House Bill 2339. It is very commonplace to obtain institutional records in criminal cases, whether it be for purposes of investigating criminal conduct that's before a grand jury that's making that ultimate decision, or for its evidentiary value for a criminal case, and for that matter, a civil case in front of a court. Good examples for the committee would be medical records or employment records. In fact, there's a specific statute, ORS 136.447, that allows a grand jury to get medical records in front of them without notice to the individual about the obtaining those particular records. What House Bill 2339 does is aligns this process to obtain financial records, bank records, with how we currently obtain all other records in front of a grand jury or court through subpoena, and either get them to the grand jury or to a court via the particular statute that allows us to do that. This particular bill applies equally to the state and to the defendant seeking to obtain those particular records. And it eliminates a critical weakness right now, and that is that the current statutory scheme under 192.565 basically requires personal service or notice to that individual during the course of the investigation, therefore impeding the efforts of law enforcement, giving them notice, making it ripe for potential to destroy evidence or simply abscond while police are doing their investigation. That's what grand juries are for, to determine and get this evidence in front of them to determine whether a crime has been. So the statute really makes that alignment with the process as we obtain records today. I would note that these cases, these bank record cases, financial institutions, these cases are complex. They often involve multiple, if not hundreds, of victims, and they involve crimes such as financial fraud, identity theft, embezzlements, and the bottom line is we don't want to give a heads up as the grand jury makes their headway into determining whether a crime has been committed against you and I through those particular bank records. So I guess with that, I'll just talk just a little bit to the statutory scheme. The form of subpoena is under 136.575, and then 136.580 appends the documents, what we're trying to obtain, and grants that authority for the subpoena process that would go directly to the grand jury or to the court for review to get it to the parties in what we call an in-camera review. So that's, I just want to describe, there is the clearly statutory vehicle here. We're just trying to get this aligned with the way we obtain other records for purposes of investigation. With that, I'll be happy to handle any questions that you have regarding the bill.
Mr. Begala, is the only change in the law being made by this bill the statement that there's or elimination of a requirement of personal service on the individual whose records are being obtained, or is there some other change being made?
Mr. Chair, that's the substantive change. And I guess the statute just kind of points the process for these records in a clear section under ORS Chapter 136 for subpoena process. Now, granted, you should look at the financial record process under 192, but the substantive change is the notice provision, which that is eliminated through this bill.
Questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for purposes of clarity then, and perhaps I should look at 192.550, but we're talking about obtaining the financial records from financial institutions or other institutions holding said types of records, because oftentimes in a proceeding, you're not going to be going to the person who's being charged with the criminal activity and saying, you know, we need your records.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, that's correct. And so the subpoena, literally looked at it, would be the financial institution, and then on the bottom of the subpoena would have the language, please bring the following records, and that individual through the institution would then, at the grand jury subpoena ducis tecum requirement, would have those records in front of the secret grand jury process to allow the investigation that particular evidence.
Further questions? Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Just to clarify, so if I was a victim in some identity theft, this would allow the grand jury to subpoena my bank records as a victim as well for that without me knowing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, it could, yes. Often in victim cases where we're trying to obtain records, we'll just get a waiver of consent and just go straight to the institution or record to get those. But it would allow this process, if I look at the statute, kind of the broad, not only someone who, it's basically a customer. So it could include, from my perspective, that individual.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Parker.
Thank you. If after the grand jury was finished and somebody wasn't in, no indictment was issued, would you favor releasing the records of the grand jury to the public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, no.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
A follow-up to that inquiry, is there a provision that would prohibit the releasing of the records to the public?
Your secret grand jury.
Mr. Begla, I'll let you explain.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, yes, the proceedings and notes and the evidence in front of a grand jury, particularly if there is a not true bill, are to be returned to the institution or destroyed. I could do a little research and get you the exact provisions, but what happens in grand jury stays in grand jury, particularly when it comes to evidence. If there is an indictment, then potentially evidence would be brought through witnesses in a court of law. But none of the that information is public record.
Quick call.
Yes.
And I appreciate that what's said in grand jury stays in grand jury. However, it seems we have some historical, recent historical evidence in the universal context where oftentimes grand jury information is leaked and made public. So just a statement.
Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly respond, and Representative Flores, I appreciate that. I think the DAs across the state take the role, and the information and education we do them very carefully, and I think the jurors do too at the state level. I wanted to just, as my mind went through the grand jury statute, the court, individuals can apply to the court for an order review to look at what happened in a grand jury. So there is a statutory process in which there are ways to open that door, but it has to go through a judge. I can't remember the exact provision, but I do recall having that come up before. I just wanted you to have that information.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Beglaw?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beglaw. We have Andrea Meyer and Amy Alkonich. And maybe to save us some time, why don't you both come forward? You're both in opposition to this bill.
That's great. I'm going to go.
Members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to House Bill 2339. Before you, I'm handing out the statute that's referenced in this bill for your ability to read along. This is a secret subpoena without notice to an individual in a secret proceeding. And we think the removal of the right to notice is a slippery slope that we're going down that we would wholly oppose. Mr. Biglow mentioned that it happens in other abilities to get records, but that doesn't mean we should join the bandwagon and add yet another provision in our law that says they can obtain information about you and you will never know. ORS 192565 does in Section 5 require notice in a period of 10 days following the service for the customer to have the opportunity to deal with this. However, Subsection 6 gives the opportunity for law enforcement to show reasonable cause why that time should be shortened. Mr. Biglow mentioned that he was, at least if I'm correctly stating his testimony, I heard him suggest that there was a concern that if there's notice to the individual, they might take action to thwart this. But these are financial records maintained by a financial institution. Again, I believe under the law, they have the ability to go quickly forward and get these, but the person should still receive notice. Either notice sufficiently beforehand to take necessary actions, or at least within a very reasonable time upon those documents. But under this proposal, you would never get notice. And we just think that is the wrong way to go, and we urge you not to pass this bill out with that notwithstanding language set forth. There's a reason we have that law, and we shouldn't start eviscerating it piecemeal. Thank you.
Excuse me, Ms. Mark. It seems to me that sometimes at some point somebody made an inquiry about one of my accounts in my financial institution, notified me that somebody was knocking on that door. But that isn't required, or is it? I don't know.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, I believe that the reason for this law is, yes, it is required under 192565, which is disclosures under summons. Certainly, if they get a warrant, you have that process to ensure you notice. So I believe, and I'm not an expert in this area, it's called becoming a quick expert on a lot of areas, as you all know, but I believe in reading 192 that would be the basis for which you would have received notice when someone sought, or if law enforcement sought, your records. And I think it's just a matter of justice that we need to know what our government is obtaining on us at a reasonable amount of time, either before or shortly at the time, if the court believes that there's a good reason not to get it right at the time those documents are obtained.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. When I listened to the other testimony from Mr. Biglow, I sort of perceived the situation where somebody's under investigation and they need the bank records to establish the elements of the alleged crime. And if the person they're investigating finds out, he or she may go deplete the bank account or send the assets overseas or something like that. So I guess if we require the notice, how are we going to avoid that from happening?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, and my
co-witness here may be able to testify more specifically on that, because I'm not familiar, but I would think there would be abilities for law enforcement to seek an order to freeze accounts and take other necessary steps if they think that the individual under suspicion is going to remove the evidence or take the money. So I think there are other steps. And again, under this, I believe there's a process for delay if there are those grounds that they can put before a court. We think it's critical for court review. This is a subpoena that the DA gets without court review, so and we think that critical step is there, and the courts can ensure, and I'm sure there are tools available to law enforcement and the district attorneys to preserve any evidence or the goods that they think are unlawfully obtained.
Thank you.
I don't know if you...
Senator Cameron.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Meyer. But on the other side, you said the DA can get, but also the way I word this, is it not true that the defendant can be able to do this as well?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, that's correct, and I think okay. OCDLA is here to testify on, as a role of the defendant, whether notice is works for them as well
Thank
as
you.
Whether.
Well, why don't we hear from Amy Alconich here before we proceed with further questions?
Amy Alconich, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, members of the committee, Chair McPherson, actually wasn't here to testify on that, although I can speak to it a little bit and a little bit to Representative Bonamici's question. We're simply here to show that we oppose this bill primarily because of the lack of notice requirements, and I could speculate a little bit, although I'm certainly no expert on money laundering, and this is, I think, one of those situations where that may help, where I knew how you move money in and out of bank accounts. But it would seem to me that, and this is just conjecture and personal experience, I don't have any statistics or information, only cases that I've personally seen that involve financial records, specifically one case that I had with AT&T, was that it was very clear from those financial records what was going on. Even when she did have notice, the defendant that I worked with, it was clear that all of a sudden, she transferred $90,000 out of her account when she thought she was out under investigation. In my opinion, certainly I didn't advise her to do that, but that demonstrated additional guilt on top of the fact that there were 20,000 transfers from AT&T to her account. So I think that the notice requirement doesn't necessarily give somebody that option to just clear those accounts out. I mean, certainly if you're clever enough to be able to do it in a way that doesn't implicate your guilt, you know, maybe you're not depositing that money in the bank anyway. And I think we could go back and forth, and I could give a million different hypotheses on, you know, how you would transfer money so it doesn't look like you realize that they're onto you. But I do agree, Representative Cameron, Chair McPherson, that this does give the defendant also the right to subpoena those records, although we maybe don't have the same interest in secrecy that the state has sometimes. So thank you, members of the committee.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, if I can add one more thought, I want to make clear this triggering of who they can obtain a subpoena against is not necessarily a defendant suspected of criminal activity. It's anyone within the grand jury proceedings. So I know that's an issue brought up, and certainly those people will be affected, but it also could be all of us who may somehow get swept up in an investigation and not have engaged in any criminal activity. So it applies to everyone, and we're all exposed under it.
Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, can we have Mr. Bigler come back?
Certainly.
Would it be okay while he's here?
Thank
you. And before we transition, ask a question. Ms. Meyer, in the summary, we're told here that this does apply in criminal actions, and you're suggesting that this is broader in scope than criminal actions.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, it may only apply to criminal. I'm not sure because it matters before grand jury proceedings, but that doesn't mean that it only is a subpoena to the records of the individual who is subject to the investigation. It could be other people. It could be a fishing expedition. It could be a way to determine who is and is not part of an enterprise or some other steps. It may sweep in people who are never subsequently indicted. It's not narrowly tailored to the individual under investigation, and even if it were, they get a court order, get a warrant, court order to do it, and you have the checks and balances we're concerned about. This is the DA getting a subpoena without the court oversight. So if we're going to give that sort of special authority to get these to any party,
we think it reasonable that the person get notice at some time, either before or in close proximity to the obtaining of those documents.
Well, thank you for that clarification and additional follow-up statement.
May?
And in your beginning comments, you emphasize that this is a secret proceeding pertaining to, you know, a secret disclosure. So you're not challenging the grand jury process, I would presume.
Right. Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, no, we're not challenging the process, just wanting to make sure you all are aware that it is a secret process, and the subpoena under this proposal will become a secret subpoena. You'd never have the right to know that your documents were obtained.
But why don't you remain there, and Mr. Begla, if you could take the third seat up there, we can make sure we get the fullest information out for the committee. Representative Bonamici, why don't you put your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, in light of the recent testimony, Mr. Bigelow, if you could give us a little bit of background on the reason for this change and what isn't working under your current statutory scheme. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the bottom line is that when you give someone you're doing an investigation on, someone who's out there potentially stealing our identification and using the financial institutions to forward their enterprise, you give them notice, they can destroy evidence and impede the efforts to protect all of us. A good example of someone's doing bank stealing and using the banking and using the proceeds from those banks to buy new cars, beautiful cars, and you go through the current process of notice to them during the investigation, you're done. The investigators, they can sell, they can move out of state, they can get rid of the proceeds, and so your evidence begins to dwindle away very quickly. So I guess my response to the DA, it's not the DA, it's your grand jury that's facilitating a criminal investigation. And it's the court that has oversight over the grand jury, and we're coming in front of your grand jury asking them to authorize a subpoena, ducis tecum, so that we can get this records to further interests of a criminal investigation for those individuals who might be victims. Now, the victims in these cases are you and I, and often when there's a victim, we're just looking for consent to get those. The main focus of this process is to get at those individuals that are forwarding criminal activity. And if you look at the other records, if you look at, I mentioned the grand jury process for medical records, we're going to get the records of both the individual who's been hurt, because we want to know the evidence of their injuries, and we also want to know the evidence of a suspect in a particular case, whether they've been drinking or are high on methamphetamine or have injuries as well that would have impaired their ability to drive the car. So that alignment is very important, and that is the thought behind making this a tool like we have other tools so that that individuals are protected. Did you want me to respond to a few of the points or just kind of take questions, Mr. Chair? Or?
Actually, I have a question first I wanted to ask. Would it be possible to accomplish the purpose of the ODAA with a timing adjustment? That is, I think there's a discomfort about there never being any notice to somebody whose financial records are being sought, but I can understand the need to be able to pursue records before the person whose records are being pursued can conceal them or alter them or something. So, is it possible to adjust the timing so that you could pursue records with a notice after the fact that had happened, or where there was some evidence that they might be altered or there might be some concealment going on?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's possible. In fact, but the kind of the turning question there would be, from the information that they've received in the banking records, have the investigators been able to finish the investigation and obtain the evidence that they need? That would be the difficult question to answer in terms of a hard-cut question, because, like I said, some of these are very complex investigation, might involve hundreds of witnesses, and 24 hours is certainly not going to be enough. They need to go out and pound the pavement to determine what other evidence stems from the institutional records that are being utilized to forward this enterprise. So that would be the difficult question to answer, is how much time, depending on the particulars of that case.
Let me put that question to Ms. Meyer. Would it, at least in some measure, answer your concerns if we were to have a carve out where you could pursue records with notice after the fact, if it was somebody whose records, the records were for on somebody who was likely to be doing something in response?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I need to urge you to look at ORS 192.565, subsection 6. I believe the authority is already there. It allows at the end, pursuant to the court ensuring that there's a process and protections, to get it waived, to have that notice to the individual not only shortened, but waived. It seems to me that the cases being put forward are prime examples with court oversight that would happen. I don't think you need this tool today to have the authority to prevent release prematurely to an individual if they can show reasonable cause to a court. You have the tools today to do this.
Mr. Begley, could you respond to that point?
Mr. Chair, that provision is there, the court can authorize through a petition and affidavit process in that particular case, but I guess it's a question of principle. We have all the records that the grand jury is authorizing in criminal investigations, so the question is, do you want to create roadblocks for criminal investigators and your grand jury to move forward with investigations involving massive amounts of money and victimization or not? And I think that is, we haven't in these other areas where we're obtaining records to protect communities and citizens through the grand jury, this aligns that process. Why would we want not to adopt that in the bulk of criminal activity, which is fraud, embezzlement, and identity theft?
I have more of a comment than a question, and you had suggested maybe there's something that can be worked out with the timing. I think I'd feel a little bit more comfortable if there was a different approach to suspects versus the general public. Because the way that it's drafted now, they could subpoena anybody's, yours, my bank records, if we were somehow tangentially related to what was going on. And I think that we would be in a very different situation from the suspect. So I'd like to look at a way where we can address the concern of making sure that the whoever's suspected of committing the crime doesn't abscond with the assets or transfer them somewhere, but that if somebody's going to subpoena the victims or somebody else's financial records, they'd know about it.
Right. Let me direct that to Mr. Begley, although I would ask him particularly to focus on how bright is the line between the suspect who may be the subject of an indictment and others who are not. Is that a bright line? Do you always know who is and who isn't?
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty bright line, particularly when you're coming to a grand jury, because you have to demonstrate in your request for a subpoenas basic evidentiary value to what you're seeking. So that is a fairly distinct piece of information at the time the investigators go in front of a grand jury. And quite frankly, I don't know why we couldn't explore something like that. You have to understand that a grand jury can only be investigating criminal activity. That's what a grand jury does. That's the inherent authority around that particular process. So, again, we already obtain records, potentially, for example, medical records, where the victims are involved in that, and that is evidence in a case. So you have to remember, It's about people as suspects and as victims, but it's about obtaining evidence to demonstrate the case. And so that's an important principle that the grand jury is empowered to do and should be empowered to do to make sure that we get all the information for them.
Representative McPherson, I apologize, members of the committee. I would like just an opportunity quickly to point two things out. And the first is that while we're focusing on the grand jury, that this does not just apply to the grand jury. This also applies to other court proceedings. So some of the issues of secrecy, as I read it, it says the state or the defendant may obtain financial records by subpoena. Custodians of financial records shall produce records to the court before which the matter is pending, or in relationship to grand jury proceedings. Now, how I read that is that you could be having a different kind of hearing, there could be a different kind of motion, and that that may very well apply to other kinds of court proceedings that don't have the secrecy of the grand jury proceeding and don't have the same kind of safeguards that the grand jury proceeding may have. I'd also like to point out that as I read this, and maybe this is a positive for the Oregon criminal defense lawyers, is that it seems to me that as a defendant, I could subpoena the victim's records without giving them notice. And maybe I should be here testifying alongside Mr. Biglaw, but that is one of the things that I've noticed about this bill, is that it and if I could make a third point as I was talking, I don't exactly know how it would work. I don't know where it says to produce it to the court or the clerk of the court. I don't know about storage issues. I don't know. Some of these financial records are quite large and are many, many, especially in cases where there's a lot of money involved. So I don't know the technicalities of how that would work, who would store them, who would keep them secret. So those are some of the points that I thought of as we were testifying. Thank you.
Chair McPherson?
Briefly, Ms.
Very briefly, members of the committee. I was just distressed when Mr. Biglaw was asked why this process that you have before you currently doesn't work, and he said because it creates a roadblock. And I look at that as the court, and I don't like to think that our courts create roadblocks, and that may not have been what you intended, but to me the barrier here or the additional is the court ensuring review for the waiver to happen so that the subject of the investigation receives no notice. So it can happen, and I'm just distressed by that. I felt it important to say.
Okay. Committee, what I'm going to suggest as an approach here is that we urge the proponents of the bill to work with other perspectives, to see, particularly focusing on whether there's a way to narrow its focus so that it relates to those who are under investigation by the grand jury, and to so that it's pursuing the interest in not tipping them off at an inappropriate time, but so that it would not extend. I think I sense a general discomfort here about the opportunity to go after records of people who are just tangentially related to the investigation, and to bring something back to see whether we have a consensus that among the committee that can move that bill. Is that it's consistent with thinking here around the committee table?
Yes.
Very good. Well, then, excuse these witnesses, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2339. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2340. Councilor Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2340, it amends ORS 40.355 to specifically provide that a defendant who is on trial for a sex crime, who testifies at his or her trial, that defendant can be impeached by evidence that the defendant has previously been convicted of one or more sex crimes.
Mr. Biglaw, I think you're next up here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name's Walt Beglaw. I'm Marin County District Attorney, and here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, here on House Bill 2340. Oregon law provides that in criminal cases, when the defendant takes the stand, certain convictions that relate to veracity or their credibility, or by the very nature of that conviction, that will come in against them in a court of law when they, again, have exercised the right to take the stand. This particular provision, subsection 3, basically states when they're charged, defendant is charged with a sex crime as defined in the statute, and the defendant is a witness, evidence that that individual has been convicted of committing a similar crime, a sex crime, may be brought out from the defendant and or established through a public record and admitted into evidence for the purpose that is outlined in the statute around the philosophy that we're going to, if you've done something and this goes to your credibility, it should come in. This simply allows in these sex crimes the state to bring forward this in a very express way. And having been a prosecutor of these cases for quite some time, there is no greater nexus between an individual's prior conduct as it relates to the truthfulness or veracity of that individual than a sex crime or someone who has committed one. Let me restate that. There is no other crime that is more indicative or a greater nexus to their truthfulness on the stand today for under charges for a sex crime than having been convicted of one in the past. And that relates directly when they want to take the stand and exercise that right, the jury will be hearing the evidence of that conviction. And so in years past, we have demonstrated the domestic violence, kind of the dynamics of domestic violence in a prior. This is that opportunity, I believe, for those in sex crimes, and I think it is a very important and valuable tool, particularly when we're talking about kids involved in sex abuse cases. And I think I'll let it stand at that point in time. And take any questions you might have. I would note, I kind of stepped in on this morning. I haven't been trying these cases in a while, and so I might have to throw out a lifeline eventually here on how these cases are currently going, but I'll do my best.
Okay. Mr. Begla, under the current law, if I'm understanding the situation, the court has discretion over these matters. So it's not that the prior conviction of a sex crime would be prevented by current law, but that the court would exercise discretion based on the rule in the evidence code rule 403 that its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. So we would be in effect departing from that rule and saying that it could always be admitted, whether and the court would have no discretion. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. It would be basically stating in Oregon, we're taking a stand around the nexus of this behavior and an individual's charge and previously convicted, and this shall come in.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Begelow? Well, I'll pose one. And what if the prior conviction had some particularly horrific aspects to it? I mean, it was something that had sensational elements to it, and so the court under current law can decide that the factual history of that prior conviction was so dramatic that or sensational that it would be likely to more color the views the jury would have about the defendant than its impact on credibility. Do you think that it's appropriate in that situation to say that the court couldn't make a kind of a weighing? Is it, you know, is its probative value more compelling, or is its likelihood of distracting or inflaming the jury's sentiments more compelling?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your point. But I have to say, in these cases, as they're tried day in and day out, are like this. And what I would turn to is the court's capacity, and it's utilized quite frequently, to caution the jury on how to apply particular evidence in the case, with whether it be a restatement of the law as it applies or a cautionary about this is available to you for the purposes of evaluating credibility. And judges have to apply those cautionary statements around evidence that's coming before them every day. And I think in this particular category, that can be accomplished, and two, the jurors are entitled to know this information because of the dynamics that we know about in child abuse and sexual abuse and its impact on the credibility of an individual testifying in front of the jury. So I appreciate your question and your concern, but I think we have the tools in place that the court can utilize to caution the jury.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just with the scenario that you laid out, just to get some clarification, you're talking about a case in which it might be highly public, perhaps inflammatory, sensational, I think you used the word, and the person was convicted of said past crime. And if we're talking about specifically sex crimes and offenders and the nexus of prior acts to behavior, I think that should be the focus of the discussion. As I understand it, it is, and the purpose of this bill. So I, regardless of the spectacular nature of past history, that past history and conviction should be relevant to what we're trying to, what is trying to be accomplished here.
Any further questions or comments? And let's excuse Mr. Beglaw and Amy Alkonich from OCDLA.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. It's never easy getting up here and testifying about sex offender bills, frankly, because nobody wants to align themselves with sex offenders. I would like to start out, and I have to re-give myself, I haven't tried these cases in a little while either, and I probably don't have quite as much experience trying them as Mr. Biglaw does, but so I had to give myself a little evidence tutorial before I went and looked at this bill. And one of the things that I'd like to briefly explain to the members of the committee, because I think that the prior bad acts, 403, character evidence, I think it's incredibly confusing, frankly. And I've been in court before, and nobody seems to have the same answer. But I do think this is one of the areas where we can give some solid guidance to members of the committee. And the first is that these felonies, when you think about sex crimes and you think about rape and sodomy and child abuse and you know all the things that we think about as these horrific sex offenses, those are already coming in. So that even beyond the discretion of the judge, if you look at the ORS 4355, the very top of it, section 1, it reads, for the purpose of attacking the credibility of a witness, evidence that the witness has been convicted of a crime shall be admitted if elicited from the witness or established by public record only if the crime was, I'm going to skip the punishable by death, or imprisonment in excess of 1 year. So if you have been convicted of a rape or sodomy or a sex abuse, then that's coming in. It doesn't have to be a crime of dishonesty or truthfulness. It's if you take the stand and your credibility is going to be attacked. Now, this is not for propensity evidence.
Let me just break in, Ms. Alkonich, because maybe I misunderstood. So there, the judge has no discretion about that. The judge can't say this terrible felony, prior felony sex offense, is more likely to inflame the jury than it is really going to bear on the evidence before the jury.
Not that I wouldn't ask for a hearing if I was a defense attorney and try and argue that and make the record, but my understanding and my experience with this and is that that is coming in to the case. And I think that the judge can limit the facts of the case that come in because they're too prejudicial. But if I get on the stand and I testify, I love children. I would never hurt a child. Then as the DA, I can impeach that their credibility by saying, well, isn't it true that 15 years ago you were convicted of a sex abuse one against a 12-year-old? And if I were the judge, I still have the discretion, and this is my reading of the evidence code and our legislative committee's reading and our collective experience. We had a long discussion about this yesterday, and everyone on our committee agreed that that would come in. So part of this is voicing theirs, and part of it is
Excuse me, but you say it would come in because the judge would allow it in, or is the judge, or is the judge's hands tied because it is permitted by law to come in?
I would argue, and I guess I can't give you 100% answer, but my understanding is that evidence of that conviction could come in, and I don't know
I think what the judge can limit, if they feel it's prejudicial, is are the facts of the case. I think that Section 1, 40, 355 pretty much makes it clear that, just like the section in the back that's asking to be admitted, Section 3 that we're talking about today, it has the exact same language, which is that evidence that the witness has been convicted of a crime shall be admitted if elicited from the witness and there is imprisonment in excess of 1 year. And so my understanding is that this would come in. I think that it's part of what I found so confusing and find so confusing about prior bad acts is that it kind of gets muddled sometimes between charged and uncharged cases. And when we think about and misdemeanors, which is, I think, really what they're trying to get out with this bill, frankly, is that there's a series of sex offenses as defined by the statute that are misdemeanors, which are not eligible to come in under the current law. So that's what I think this bill is trying to get at. And when I think of misdemeanors, I think of attempting to promote prostitution. That would come in under the statute. Sex abuse 3, which is a touching case. We just think of them as kind of a simple touching case. Breast to buttocks, hand to breast, those kind of things. Often over the clothes. The misdemeanors, and that's what I think they're trying to get at with this bill.
So really, the example I was posing earlier probably isn't the case this is dealing with, where there's a very inflammatory, kind of dramatic event in the past. It's really lesser offenses that are of a misdemeanor level. Whether those would be automatically allowed to come in.
That would be my reading of this, is that you're not going to, if you're the DA, you're not going to have a problem if the defendant takes the stand getting in. I mean, maybe the defendant is going to be sparkling clean and there'll be no chances really of attacking his credibility, or maybe he admits to them. I mean, often you'll have a defendant take the stand and say, you know, 10 years ago I made a mistake and I touched a girl, or whatever, I'm just giving an example. So I don't think that that's what this bill is trying to get at. I think it's trying to get at the lesser offenses.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. If I might, for purposes of our understanding, that the amendment as proposed states that the defendant is charged with a sex crime as defined in ORS 181-594, and the defendant is a witness. If I might just read the definition of sex crime in the statute means rape in any degree, sodomy in any degree, unlawful penetration in any degree, sexual abuse in any degree, incest with a child victim, using a child in a display of sexually explicit conduct, encouraging child sexual abuse in any degree, transporting child pornography into the state, paying for viewing a child's sexually explicit conduct, compelling prostitution, promoting prostitution, kidnapping, excuse me, in the first degree if the victim was under 18 years of age, contributing to the sexual delinquency of the minor, sexual misconduct if the offender is at least 18 years of age. None of those seem to be listed in the prior sections dealing with evidence that might be used to attack the credibility of the defendant, and the sex crimes as defined in ORS 181-594 are a little bit more broad, in my opinion, than misdemeanors.
And Representative McPherson, Representative Flores, if I may briefly respond, if I understand. And certainly, I don't think up for debate are some of these really horrendous, where I think the DA's office and the criminal defense lawyers would all agree, you know, are particularly disturbing cases. Our concern lays with and it's hard to say a sex offense is minor because there's always a victim in those cases, and someone is always harmed. And so it's hard to kind of call them that. But when you think about on a scale, on a of, you know, a 1 to 10, if that's even appropriate, that those cases that fall on the lower end of the spectrum that are misdemeanors, and, you know, listening to this list always kind of makes me feel a little disturbed myself. And I think certainly what it's important to look at is one that any attempt to commit any of these crimes is also included. So my example would be the promoting prostitution, which is a felony, but an attempt to promote prostitution. That's not forcing somebody to engage, although you could say that, you know, a woman is always forced to engage in prostitution at some point. But that, you know, that's something where an attempt to promote prostitution probably isn't maybe as relevant as if you had a sex case involving a child where someone had previously been convicted of abusing a child. And what, as I read this bill, what it's saying is that if I'm on the stand and I'm charged with, I'm just going to choose one. How about a felony public indecency, which is committing having sex in public more than one time and being caught, and it rises to a felony. It's not listed here, but it's one of the registrable sex offenses. And somebody says, I make comment, I've been on the stand, and this would allow the prosecutor to bring up attempted promoting prostitution, even though you and I may say, well, that's not quite relevant to this case. Maybe the fact that they have a previous conviction for that attempting to promote prostitution may not be as relevant, and this takes away the judge's discretion for those more minor sex offenses. I'm sorry, that was kind of a long-winded. Representative Flores, Chair McPherson.
Thank you. In that case, and I appreciate the longness because it helps kind of frame our thinking, but in that case, can the defense counsel not plead for the in defense of his client and the judge exercise some latitude if that person has been convicted of one of these in, sex crimes as enumerated in the statute, and therefore caution with their discretion?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I think there's two good answers to that. One is that I think the language of this bill says that it will come in and doesn't allow the judge necessarily the discretion to allow that. And I think the flip side is that these cases are so charged anyway. So when you come in and you're on a jury and we say, no, this is going to be a sex case. This case is about sex. It's about, somebody being, whatever, victimized. And that you start out at this whole different playing field of prejudice. And I think that, as you can imagine, because they are more charged cases, and so it's very hard to keep the level of prejudice down already. So allowing something like this in, even if the judge does limit the details, and I still think they may have the discretion to limit the details, it's very difficult, I think, when you introduce a prior conviction to not raise the level of prejudice beyond a place that the defendant can overcome. So I would also, if I may add one thing, if there are no more questions, that just because if this bill didn't get moved anywhere, the judge still does have the discretion to allow those misdemeanor, to allow some prior bad acts in under the evidence code, and I won't go in to how you would get those in, but they're not necessarily always going to be excluded. So it's not all or nothing. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. I haven't been in court for a few years either, but it was my experience, it seemed like a lot of times there'd be a fairly serious crime, and through the plea bargaining process, compelling prostitution would be reduced to attempting, and those kind of things. So some of these misdemeanors, the case really, the person was, in my opinion, a badder actor than the court record would show. And while a judge would have discretion to allow it in, the judge also has discretion to exclude those. And I think in hearing the testimony, I'm inclined to support the bill based on the fact that the judge has, in the end, can give the instructions to the jury, and he can, quantify the danger. And I understand where you're saying that it would probably be prejudicial, but I think that's kind of the intent as well of the bill, is that somebody who's involved in a pattern of sex crimes, that should be before the jury. And, I mean, I know somebody used to have a joke about, I swear to tell a cop, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and anything they'll let me. But not all of it, because you're going to not allow me to tell all the truth. And so I think, based on all the testimony I've heard, I hear your concerns, but I think I'm going to tip the other way on that one.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking for a clarification to understand how this whole thing works. And it could be part of my confusion comes because the Section 1 seems to be drafted as for the purpose of attacking the credibility of a witness, but the new section is talking about the defendant, and I'm assuming that under Section 1, if it, that applies to defendants as well as to just witnesses in the case. But the way I understand this is that if the crime was punishable by imprisonment in excess of 1 year, then the evidence that of the conviction shall be admitted. So this is only the new portion of the statute that's proposed is only looking at crimes that were punishable by less than 1 year. Is that correct?
Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, that's my understanding of this bill.
Okay. And under existing law, those are handled under 403, not under statute.
Under existing law, there's a case called Johns that has a test, which is the prior bad acts test, and there's, I think, five prongs, and I won't go through all five of them, but in that case, if you want to get prior bad acts in, you'd go through the Johns test in a hearing in front of the court, and the judge would have the discretion to decide whether or not those would come in.
Thank you. Any follow-up, please, Mr. Chair? Some of you were in the room last week when we had the testimony about the exception for reporting bill that had to do with the 18-year-old teenager who had sex with his girlfriend on high school graduation night. Is that the kind of thing that would come within the new language?
My Representative Bonamici, Chair McPherson, my understanding is that that would come in already, that that's a rape. And it depends, and I think Representative Barker made a good point, which is that, you know, what you're charged with and what you wind up convicted sometimes, so I can only guess that how that would be charged would be a rape three. And if you were convicted of the charge as it was indicted, that would already come in under
Section 1. Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought you were going to go there, trying to be clear on this. If I look at Section 2 and Section 2A and B, today I highlighted the family and the household member. So if these crimes that were listed down here were against a family or a household member, and I'm trying to get at the purpose of those crimes can be brought in to discredit a defendant, correct, as the existing bill is. So we're looking at domestic abuse ongoing behavior here, and our policy is saying that those crimes are going to be brought in. So what we're trying to do is say, in this case, on sexual predator, sexual abuse, we're saying we want to treat those very similar to domestic abuse cases. Is that a pretty accurate statement on what this bill would do?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think that you hit the nail on the head. That we have.
Thank you. That's all I need.
If there are no further questions, we'll excuse Ms. Alkonich and close the public hearing on House Bill 2340. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2340. Received a lot of input on this bill. Are people of a mind where that ready to consider moving this out?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
I would hope that we move this bill out with a 2000 recommendation, specifically because we are focusing on the area of sex crimes as listed by the statute that I've read into the record, and narrowing the focus on the defendant when he has chosen that defendant, he or she is put on the stand to be a witness that their prior list of sexual abuse crimes would be used to impeach or to focus on their credibility. So I'm hoping we move forward with it.
Any other discussion? Representative Kahn.
Clarification. Cannot the judge do this already? Can this not already occur?
Yes, I think that what we heard was that the court has discretion under this procedural rule to let these lesser offenses in based on the standard of whether it's more probative or more prejudicial to the defendant.
Okay, because I'm hesitant to move it out.
Okay. All right.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to make the motion.
Oh, I just...
I'd like to hear more discussion.
I didn't know this more discussion.
A comment.
Sure.
I think we're making a policy choice here, and the way the language is in the amendment for the purpose of attacking the credibility of the defendant, and we had the testimony that people who engage in sex crimes, that evidence needs to come out if they have the prior conviction because they're more inclined to either commit more crimes or lie about them or something. And I guess because nobody testified opposite to that, I think we have to make that very tough choice. In the other statute, in the beginning of the existing statute, it talks about the legislature's made the policy choice either punishable by death or imprisonment of more than 1 year, or involving a false statement or dishonesty, which of course makes sense if you're trying to impeach someone that they've been convicted of being dishonest in the past. But I guess we're being asked to make that leap. Are we impeaching them with a prior conviction of a sex crime? We're not saying they were dishonest. So it's just a choice.
Representative Barker?
This would allow in more evidence, and what will happen is what happens if you already have the rape case. Your defense attorney is going to say, you're not going on the stand. I mean, this is only if they go on the stand and it's, you know, to point out that they had prior. So I don't know how many people this will affect because I don't know how many will go on the stand if they have that prior record. But I'm supportive of it, and I'll make a motion whenever you're ready for one.
Well, I guess the question is whether any further time would allow people to become more comfortable with the idea or not. We're early in the session, so there's not as much pressure perhaps on moving bills as we experience later on. At some point, we have to make decisions on things, even if we're uncomfortable with them. I guess sensing some discomfort here at the committee, what I'll do is close the work session today. We'll let this one steep for a little bit longer and bring it back. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2340. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2342.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2342 expands the crime of furnishing false information to an officer. Under present law, ORS 162.385, there are two situations where a defendant can be charged with false information to an officer. One is if the officer is simply attempting to issue a written citation to the person and send them on their way, and the person gives a false name. The second situation is where perhaps the officer is taking the person into custody, the person is giving a false name as they're going into custody, and the officer determines at some point that the person had a warrant out for the person's arrest. Those are the two situations presently which furnishing false information can be charged. What House Bill 2342 does is to add a sort of third prong, and that is for persons who are actually being arrested and taken into custody, who are giving false names, but who don't have a warrant out for their arrest.
Ms. Skinner from the ODAA will first up.
Good morning again, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. This bill does a couple of things to assist law enforcement officers when they're in the field. Our primary concern when the District Attorney Association proposed House Bill 2342 was one thing that counsel, when discussing the bill, talked about. The current law allows if a police officer in the field arrests an offender for a warrant. But specifically, if you look at the wording of the statute, the wording says an arrest warrant. So currently under the law, the officer can only charge somebody with, and the district attorney can only charge somebody with, lying about their name when being arrested if it's an arrest warrant. There is actually a distinction in the law between an arrest warrant and a bench warrant. An arrest warrant is when someone has already been charged with a crime, either by a grand jury or a district attorney's gone through the process and gotten a warrant through a judge
to charge somebody with a crime and that person has not yet been found. And then the person gets arrested on the arrest warrant and is brought in for their very first court appearance. That's an arrest warrant. And actually, the percentage of warrants out there that are arrest warrants are very, very small in the broad scheme of things. Most warrants are what are called bench warrants, and those are when someone has already been arraigned originally on the charge, is out of custody, and has been told to come back for a further court proceeding, whether it's their trial or a pretrial hearing, and they fail to appear. If they fail to appear, at that point, it's a bench warrant. And then if... Or another way a warrant comes about is if somebody is on probation or parole and they have absconded from probation or they have failed to comply with their conditions of probation and a warrant has been issued to bring them back in on a probation violation. Under those circumstances, it is not considered an arrest warrant under the law. And so if a police officer comes upon a person, usually a police officer is not going to know what kind of warrant. They're just going to know there is a warrant, and that's going to be flagged when they run the person. So the obvious policy concern we have is when police officers are out and they come upon somebody, that they want to know their true name so that they can accurately deal with the person. And so we want to encourage offenders by having it be a crime if they lie to the police officer about their name by giving their true name. Most commonly, offenders lie about their names because they know they have a warrant. And so they hope to avoid detection, hope to avoid being arrested, lie about their name, and go about their business. That does not help the system to be able to facilitate the rapid resolution of cases, because most of these are people that are in the process. They have failed to appear for a trial. Victims are waiting for a case to be resolved, and if officers can't go out and adequately find the people, identify them, bring them in, then we are not going to be able to pursue justice in a quick manner that we would like. So as a result, we would want to broaden that definition of warrant, and that's why we were asking for the language of the basis of probable cause. So that will include both an officer arresting somebody on an original offense that they're lying about their name, and that in itself creates problems for the system. When someone gets arrested for an offense, they lie about their name. They often use somebody else's name that they actually know. They rarely just make up a name, and so now they've created an arrest record for this other person that's out there that's actually quite difficult for that other person to have to sort of undo. And they will go through the whole system with this false name. So we want to be able to charge that person with giving a false name. We want to also give the tools to the police officer to charge that person at the scene for the crime of giving a false name if, in fact, they do lie on any kind of a warrant.
Any questions for Ms. Skinner? Well, hearing none, we'll excuse you and invite up both of the other two witnesses who are signed up, Andrea Meyer and Amy Alconich.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I actually want to call this the bill of the wrong apostrophe. I'm not sure why officers became possessive in sections A, B, and C. But we're adding to the problem by adding this new section with that same parent error. ACLU is concerned about the scope of this bill and who it can sweep in. My understanding, and I didn't have a chance to review legislative history, is that this is sort of the incremental piecemeal add-on to create this crime. And that last session, it was citations, was added on Section A. So now back here again for another. The proponents of this really spoke to a bench warrant, but we're really very concerned about people who may not know that there's probable cause to be arrested and saying, my name's Daffy Duck. We're particularly concerned about targeting protesters who may, for reasons, make it a little bit more difficult. They get arrested. They get hauled in. If they're going to be arraigned, then to even be released, they have to give their name. And to create a new crime is alarming to us in those kinds of situations. I believe there's already the tools available. If you're interested in moving this bill forward, I would really encourage you to narrow it to the issues that were presented by the proponents, which is bench warrant, not simply probable cause. I don't think I'm just not clear that someone would know if the officer says, hey, what's your name? And then, by the way, you're arrested and you've given a false name, or you said, I'm not answering, or something. Even, as I said, Daffy Duck, where you're kind of protesting. that you could be brought in under this, and that's just not the direction we would encourage the committee to go. It seems too far. Thank you.
Ms. Alconich?
Neil Conich on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Representative McPherson, members of the committee. I would only briefly like to voice our opposition to this and would suggest that perhaps all the parties could get together and talk about a way to narrow this. It sounds like maybe possible, and would like to clarify the records issue, and I can only speak to the court records, which I have some experience with, which is that this will not create a new record in the court system. I cannot speak to LEDs and the police system. Perhaps members of the committee already have experience with that in district attorney's office, but I do have experience with the court records. And what will happen if you give somebody else's name in the court record system is that you will then be otherwise known as. So when your real name is pulled up in the court system, you'll have a list of AKA, sometimes 5 pages long, otherwise known as Daffy Duck, otherwise known as John Smith, otherwise known as John W. Smith, otherwise known as so on and so forth. So it won't be attributed to a different individual, at least in the court system. And again, I can't speak to the LEDs or police system, but it won't be implicating, at least under that court record system, a trigger for somebody who is a friend or a relative whose name is given. And that's all my testimony. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. When somebody does give the false name, it was my experience that they usually did use somebody else's name. They frequently used a family member because they were too dumb to know how to spell other names and date of birth. And so they would use that, but it would do things if you didn't know who you were talking to. It would clog up the system. A warrant would be then, of course, the person doesn't know he's been arrested. A warrant then comes out, and then you go through all this stuff again. At great inconvenience to the innocent brother. And just the one anecdotal story I had, which I thought was pretty funny, one time I had Brother A, who thought he was wanted, so he gave me Brother B's name, and Brother B was actually wanted. So when we were arrested, and then the guy's trying to tell me, no, I'm not really, and this was before these were crimes to get false evidence. But anyway, it is a real problem, and so I would have no objection if somebody wanted to work to try to narrow this a bit, but people who are giving false names when they're being arrested should be charged additionally, in my opinion.
I would say the dispositive point has already been made by Ms. Meyer, which is that there is an excess apostrophe.
Yeah.
And we're not going to move a bill out with an excess apostrophe. So the bill does need to be amended to cure that defect. And I would say if we could get something that is at or approaching a consensus on this bill, that would be fine. I would say that, speaking as just one member of the committee, that the problem of creating tools so that we can get correctly established identity is an appropriate and valid function for our law enforcement people, and I would want to make sure we have give them the appropriate tools for that. So with that guidance, if you could work both to cure the excess apostrophe. And I think that actually existing law may have that same defect if I look at A.
Chair McPherson.
And B.
Yes, it's.
So they're
my parents will be proud of me that I can.
Right.
So your English teacher.
So we'll ask that those be amended and that at the same time we try to draw those perspectives together. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2342. That concludes our agenda for today, committee. Thank you very much for your attendance. We're adjourned.